we've diminished in quantity, but certainly not quality. So the cream has risen to the top. What's it? The cream of perseverance, right? Okay, let's begin with just settling our mind with one round of the 9-round meditation on expelling the defiled winds. Sit comfortably. If you want to begin with, as when you do it with regard to tantric meditations, try to visualize the central channel. It can start from this, what's called the brow aperture, or in this case, it can just imagine starting here, but it goes from the brow aperture to the crown of the head, straight, parallel to the spine, just a little bit in front of the spine, through the throat chakra to the heart chakra here. We're not worried about the rest of the central channel. And the two side channels begin at the nostrils, parallel, they go up, and they are paralleling the central channel, starting here, up around the top of the head. At the crown chakra, they encircle the central channel. There's a knot there, a chakra. Going down to the throat, there's another encircling there. And at the heart, they encircle, each one encircles the right and left channels, or nadis they call, encircle the central channel 3 times. So that is the most difficult chakra to open, to loosen up. So we'll begin, do one round of the 9-round breathing meditation. then as before, try to stabilize in an unstructured sense of your mind, that is to say, without any preconceptions of how it exists. You're just trying to observe it without any preconceived ideas. You might try to imagine absorbing, absorbing back the eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue consciousness, and their winds, the supporting winds to the heart. In the cave of your mind, just watching the events within your mind, first of all. Not following the thoughts, they begin to dissolve back into the mind. They diminish in intensity, and the frequency at which they might reoccur, it becomes less. Also, with previous experience, in the previous sessions, you may have a remembering consciousness of this clear light state. See if you can recall that to get back into that equipoise on the spacious, cognitive, clear light nature of the mind. Employ the factor of mindfulness to keep a continuity once you've glimpsed that clarity. But if it lapses, you might have to apply some reasoning again. The thoughts, the images, even the appearance of my body or the light from my eyes appearing to my mental consciousness is just that, an appearance. That I don't have to pay attention to. It's not the very nature of the mind. Its very presence indicates that there's spaciousness there. The unobstructing nature of the mind. Let go of the objective thought and focus on the clear light nature within which it's emerging. Excessively absorbing your attention further and further in subtlety, let go of the appearance of your body, which may be looming there. That's just an appearance to the mind. As you concentrate on the spaciousness within which it's appearing, rather than the appearance itself, you deprive it, that appearance, of its longevity, and it begins to dissolve back into the nature of the mind, which you're just focusing on. More subtle than that appearance, the appearance of the body, which we've tried to let go of, the sense of an observer, the self. Here we're not using logic to refute this. It's not an understanding of emptiness, but just recognize that appearance doesn't have to be attended to, that it is appearing within the consciousness, which is clear light by nature. Focus on that substratum of the mind rather than the objective thought image of the self. If you find yourself caught in a mass, as though your mind is tangled, just loosen up. Loosen your apprehension. Relax for a moment the mind. Again, settle on that clarity. If you're beginning to feel that you're not apprehending anything at all, no longer have in mind the clarity, tighten your awareness. Try to recall that clarity and hold on to it, like tuning a stringed instrument, successively trying to find the sweet point of being exactly the right tension between holding tightly of the mind and letting loose. what we're trying to concentrate on here is a very subtle object, difficult to find to begin with, this clear light nature of the mind turning inward with this Buddhist meaning of introspection, not just looking at your thoughts as objects and evaluating them, which most people don't do, but turning to see the subjective nature of the mind. Just as a reference, without changing anything, just notice, just observe your breathing right now. It may be, if you're succeeding, much more subtle, rhythmic and slow than it was even when you were watching the breathing. Because the object you're observing here is the very subtle, clear light nature of the mind. And think, to enhance this experience, in order to heal myself, to eventually realize selflessness of person, selflessness of the mind, the emptiness of the mind, I'm going to participate in the final sessions today on the Mahamudra as medicine. Is Dharma medicine, the one true medicine to overcome the problems of samsara. I'm going to listen to the teachings in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And slowly bring your attention back to present. How was your meditation? Any observations? Oh.
Thank you for your teaching. Since this is going to be the last, you know, your last teaching, I just want to make sure that...
It's not going to be my last. It sounds like the last... Last Supper.
Here.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Here, and I'm turning it.
I thought it was some prophecies.
I'm sorry.
My last teacher, I was a little worried. Okay.
I'm sorry. So, just want to make sure that I'm doing this, you know, correctly, or that I'm, you know, focusing or finding what I'm supposed to find.
Yeah.
So, my question is, when you say, see if you can absorb your eye consciousness and sound, ear consciousness, you...
Right now we can't do that in actuality. We imagine that,
imagining.
And it helps to bring your attention away from that, to just focusing at the heart.
Okay.
You actually cause the winds to absorb to the heart is something in meditation that would require sort of tantric practices that were almost like completion stage practices of tantra. So not even, but it is helpful, like the analogy of a tortoise or turtle withdrawing its limbs at the side. You can take your attention away from the entrances.
Right.
You're not going to be getting all done, but so even though there's some light coming in, you're not paying attention to that or to the sounds so much.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I was doing that, you know, like not paying attention to that. And then basically what I'm supposed to be doing is like withdrawing my attention from, you know, everything else. And my next question was, when you focus on the, you know, like when you say focus on the heart, are we supposed to be doing that every single time?
No, not here. That's just an aid to begin to get your attention away from the senses.
Okay.
In higher tantric meditations, maybe to be familiar with that location will be beneficial, leave an imprint. But here, the general gross consciousness has no particular location in the body, certainly not in the brain.
Right.
Not necessarily located there. It has no particular location. But it can be experienced wherever we put our attention. Main point here is just to let go of your... You can even scan, say, it's not the eye consciousness I'm thinking of. And, mm-hmm. as though withdrawing your attention away from that, not the ear. Actually spend some time listening. That's not what I'm going to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
The mental consciousness, not the nose. The taste. I have some Coke, Pepsi on my tongue.
Okay.
Not that. Not the tactile consciousness. Not the sense of the body, which is being apprehended by your mind via mostly through the tactile consciousness. You know, the sense of the presence of your body. Just mental consciousness. That little, as I sometimes say, like the cave at your heart chakra. Although, again, it's in the Sutra Mahamudra, we don't have to be thinking of a particular location, but that helps me because it also leaves an imprint, I think, for further practice in Tantra, where you actually will be going to various locations, trying to think of various locations.
Okay.
And then, okay. Let someone else have a chance. Yeah. Oh, I thought you had a question.
I do.
Oh, you do.
About the homework.
Oh, homework. Okay.
I
want to know what grade you got, right?
I found that I was. You mentioned non-obstructing and cognizant as different ways to approach it. I found myself thinking that I'm doing that at the same session. So I'm not picking one. I would do one and then the other. Am I making a mistake?
I think it's okay. Generally, here it's mainly emphasizing the clear light nature, even though there are these two things. The mind is that which is clear and knowing. As my understanding is, it's like the definitions of the elements, like fire is that which is hot and burning. So hot or heat is the nature of fire. Burning is its function. Right? Consciousness is that which is clear and knowing. So in analogy to that, the nature is clarity. Its function is cognition or knowing. So both are present. So even though you're watching the clarity of the mind, you will indirectly know that the nature of even that mind that you're looking at, its nature is knowing, cognition, because that which you're knowing it by, it's also mind, is knowing that. The fact that you're aware of that indirectly, you're focusing on the clarity, but because you're knowing that clarity, indirectly you're apprehending the cognitive function of the mind. You might at other times put your emphasis on the cognizing and indirectly be understanding the clarity.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, is going by order of appearance of hands, isn't it?
So I have...
Yeah. Give that to Venerable so she can bring it. She's in the middle, she can get to the other people. Sure. So Nila, hi.
So I have two questions. So the first one, you say the clear light, L-I-G-H-T.
Yes, and not L-I-T-E. Not, or L-I-G-H. What is it? Light, late weight is spelled the same as light?
Yes. So that's my question. You mean light as in light emitting?
Light.
Radiating?
Right, yes.
Okay. And what I noticed is when I calm my mind, it starts to wiggle. It reminds me of my sons when they were little. They could sit still for a few seconds, and then there's this... And so is the goal to then just refocus on the breath and try to calm it again? Because it wiggles.
For those of you who don't know, that's a technical term. We have to get familiar with this, and it takes some time. So you will have some various artifacts, like appearances to the mind that seem intractable, or the mind is doing something. Like the example of the crow that's sent off of the ship, off the mast, off the crow's nest, circling. Eventually, if you just, without trying to squeeze, that wiggling will go away. Okay. You'll be left in a calm state, and that may take a long time. Maybe the crow flies around a long time. It may be that crow also represents when you have a train of thought, thinking of, you know, this or that, by association, one thought leading to the other. Sometimes it's good to cut that off or to immediately try to think, what is the fact that this is thought is appearing means that the space of the mind within which it appearing, within which it's occurring to me, has this unobstructing, clear nature, and withdrawing your attention from that thought. At other times, let it go. Just let it play out. If your mind is finding that when you try to analyze, it's becoming too tight, just let it go, like the example of the crow. Finally, you'll come back to a clear. There are many different methods to, in this Mahamudra tradition, to try to recall, to first of all, to identify that state. So you may remember if you've received teachings on tranquil abiding here, has Geshe-la taught tranquil abiding? What's the first instruction, or what's the first fault? There's supposed to be, what, four or five faults? What's the first fault? What is it called? What, laziness? So forth. That one of the faults also is forgetting the instruction. Have you heard that? What does that mean? Pardon? Losing the plot. We could rephrase it. What it means is that you don't have a clear appearance of the object that you're supposed to be concentrating on. Say the guru explains, Guru Shakyamuni is seated with his hand here, with this color body. That means the instruction. Forgetting that means, what am I thinking about? You know, what am I supposed to visualize? Here, the object is not something that's easily described, clear light nature of the mind. So even to find the object, the instruction is to focus on the clear light nature of the mind. It's clear in knowing. There's all these different descriptions. So it's so much more subtle than just describing, because you can see an image of the Buddha. Imagine that. That's not what you don't look at it with your eye consciousness, right? You do to get an idea of what that looks like, get a mental image, not an after image. Do you know what I mean? Like when you look at something, you look at a candle and you close your eyes, there's still looks like the candle on your retina. Not that. A mental image that and you look again, the ears like this. At the beginning. Later, you just recall that. If you lose that, that's called forgetting the instruction. Here, to find the object is very difficult. And that's what we're sometimes at this stage, if you're saying wiggling this or that, we haven't found the object yet. So just say that wiggling is taking place within the spaciousness of my mind. And let go of your preoccupation with the wiggling. That is to say, your focus on the wiggling, or whatever it might be. And just try to sense the clarity of the mind within which it's arising. Or, as Susie was asking about these two things, cognition and appearance of spaciousness, ask yourself, what is the consciousness? Let me focus on the subject mind rather than the object wiggling. What is the mind, the cognition that's perceiving that, as though turning your back around on someone who's in your face, you know? The wiggling is there, and just ignoring that and trying to perceive the cognitive nature of the mind that's perceiving that. You can go back and forth. Someone else? Oh, you had two. Yeah.
No, that was it.
Yes, okay. Patrick has back there. Yeah. Oh, I'm not sure who's next.
Let's see. This seemed very coherent last night when I was rehearsing it to myself, and it probably won't come out that way right now.
Okay.
In doing the, attempting to do the homework, I was struck by, the steps of the instructions in terms of kind of attempting to understand, having a conceptual idea, creating a mental image, then attempting to have some experience of it, and direct. And I kind of was struck by I just kept going back to the Lam Rim, the guided path. Mm-hmm. And then, and not that I have even an intellectual understanding of the ultimate nature of reality, but what kept coming up was that attempting to follow the instructions that you gave us in terms of looking at the conventional clear light nature of the mind, I had this sense in a visceral way of the first time of how a direct perception of emptiness or experience of emptiness and the direct perception of the conventional nature of the mind can exist without each other. And so I don't know if that's a complete misperception. And so I thought I would check in.
Okay. So.
And I don't know if that was at all clear.
Yeah. I thought it was more of a story than a question, but at the end the question came. Okay.
Yeah, got it.
So. Here we're not, we have, in fact, today is hopefully when we're going to introduce the, some analysis about emptiness. Up till now, we've just been looking at the conventional clear light nature of the mind, which, like when we talk about generating bodhicitta, Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, even you spend your whole life just on the meditation called equalizing, equanimity meditation between friend, stranger, and enemy, they're all over the course of time equal in having been friend, enemy, and stranger, which is a prelude before all the other meditations on bodhicitta. Even you spend your whole life on that, great value. So here, even you spend your whole Mahamudra experience just on trying to recognize the clear light nature of the mind. Oh, what a great imprint for future lives. As Jack was saying the other day, like next life you'll hit the ground running. You're already, as a little child, my mind is clear light. clear light, by the way, is that in Tibetan is Ösel, which is the name of Lama Yeshe's reincarnation. Ösel Rinpoche. Ö means light, Selwa means clear. Ösel. It's also the name of one of the tantric stages, you know, clear light. So I don't know. So you're grafting to that experience some understanding of emptiness, which is good. In fact, as we said before, there's no way that we can have an understanding of the emptiness of the mind or of the person which is divorced from that object. The emptiness of the person is of one entity with the conventional person. They're not separate things. Like in the Heart Sutras, it says, form is empty, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. So you may have been having a little revival or rehearsal of that in your meditation. Patrick, do you have a question? It's on.
Yes. I just wanted to characterize a little bit of what my experience with this last meditation or attempt at the beginning. Because I found that what I was struggling with was trying to avoid trying to visualize the mind as the clear light. And I felt like I was getting a little bit confusing it with a meditation on the blue sky or empty sky thing. And this afternoon, what I was feeling was, it was more like I was in an attic, and I was just, it was, things were fairly dark, and I wasn't, and so I was, I didn't have that thought, but while I was waiting to ask the question,
right.
It was like I was hoping that the light was going to come on.
So,
does that?
So, initially in the text, it gives advice to settle yourself in an unstructured state of mind without any anticipation of what the mind is like. Without having it, you know, like, oh, it's the universal mind, as someone said in the morning talk to the general public. Just observe rather than preconceived, have an idea how it is. But after time, once you've begun to get a little glimpse of the mind, you can start from there. You can have a remembering consciousness of that and proceed from there. Try to stabilize on that and let go a sense of clarity. Not like, the mind doesn't have any color. So it's not like when you look in the sky on a clear day, we usually say the blue sky, right? You know why the sky is blue? Why is the sky blue?
There are nitrogen molecules in the atmosphere. It's what the sun bounces off of, and it gives a blue hue because of that specific chemical that's in the air. Yeah. If it was a different chemical, it'd be a different color.
Do you understand? When I was in college, we sang to our dates on Saturday night, this prison. Tell me why the stars do shine. Tell me why the ivy twines. Tell me why the sky's so blue. And I will tell, dear, just why I love you. You know that one? The old song? So it was MIT, so the answer was, nuclear fusion makes the stars to shine. Tropisms make the ivy twine. Raleigh scattering makes the sky so blue. This is more the fundamental, the kind of scattering, Raleigh scattering. Testosterone, dear, is why I love you. Okay. So it's not the nature, this cult, the mind doesn't have a particular color. There's no Raleigh scattering, or as I forgot your name, Russ, Jeff, as Jeff said, off nitrogen or something else. The mind has no particular color, no color at all. It's not an object. So objects of eye consciousness have shape and color, but we can have memories in our mental consciousness. We can imagine colors, you know, recall colors, but the consciousness, the nature of the consciousness itself, the clear light nature, has no color, which is a little bit befuddling. When I gave the example of the aquarium, and someone takes me to the aquarium and says, look at the clear water. So it's clear. There's no color. I mean, it may look a little bit blue from the distance or something, or has some sediment in it. Sediment in it, not sentiment. But if it's clear water, it's difficult to get an idea where it is because it's clear. So one has to infer its existence at first by noticing the fish and so forth. So here, one constructively can get back to that feeling of the clarity of the mind by just noticing the contents. And even if the content seems to be black, you know, darkness, that darkness could not be present in the mind, because it isn't always present in the mind. It couldn't be present in the mind now unless the mind had a clear nature that was unobstructing. So just using that logic at that point, let go of the darkness. And it's not as though suddenly, like in the commercials on TV, ta-da, some music and everything is bright, but there, you have a sense of the clarity, not necessarily a bright light. Okay? So we have to find a balance again there between assuming what the mind looks like, which we're advised against at the beginning, just to observe rather than starting to think how it is from the very beginning. But then when we start to get an understanding of it, we can call back a remembering consciousness. Have you heard that term before? Remember, I mean, the words we know, remembering and consciousness. But that means a consciousness, a recollection of what we've experienced before. That from the highest philosophical point of view, the Prasangika school, a recollection of emptiness is what's called a direct perception of emptiness, even if your recollection is one of a conceptual realization. Right, anyway, subtle point. So a recollection can be a valid way of knowing something if it is based on if you're remembering something which was valid, which was correct. So if you've had some experiences over time in your Mahamudra meditation on the clarity, simply trying to recall that as a starting point, and then recognizing that is itself a mental image of the clarity of the mind, as though trying to sense something more subtle within which that mental image is appearing. Even your mental image of clarity, let go of that. You have some sense of finer clarity. Let go of that. Finer clarity. Let go of that. Let go, let go. At a certain point, you reach a certain state of stability. Then you don't have to keep on letting, you know, thinking, let go. Hold that single-pointedly. But another thing that helps when the mind is dark, if it persists for some time in a meditative session, is to take off, you know, to make some space under your arms, take off your sweat if you have a sweater on so your body is a little cooler. In some cases, sprinkle some water on your face. Once in Laodo, when Lama Zopan and the rest of us were doing, in his little cave, doing Chenrezig retreat, and late in the afternoon, Lama Pasang, I remember, was beginning to nod. Lama Zopan took the water from the bowl in the altar and poured it on his head, rather than sprinkling it in his face. So that's kind of radical. Or get up, leave the session, start, and then you walk around, look at the sky. But during the meditative session, to revive the mind, you can imagine your consciousness, let's say, as though it's at the heart chakra, and imagine shooting it out, the crown of your head, into space. So it's way up above the clouds, seeing clarity, and then imagine coming back down again. That sometimes can revive in the meditation session. For a long period of time, one of the incredible, powerful things is Vajrasattva meditation. The third one, where you imagine from Vajrasattva's heart mantra and consort heart mantra, light coming down to your heart chakra, and your whole mind becomes white, you know, as though someone turned on white light, as opposed to dark, you know, the darkness. That darkness is filled with white light, purifying the negative karma instincts that sometimes are the cause for our having a little bit dull mind. So that might help also. But for me, even when that comes, just to remind yourself, just like when you have some sense of clarity, you say, let go of that, sense something's clearer. Certainly when it's dark, let go of that. Try to sense the clarity within which that's arising. The fact that the mind is not like molasses, where something is difficult to move out of the mind. The fact the mind has no obstructing nature. Thoughts can dissolve back into it or emerge from it without any inertia or what, you know, like any friction. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, last question, because otherwise we won't finish the text. Well, maybe that would be good, then we'll have to come back sometime and finish the text.
Hopefully it's a quick question. Okay. In regards to the meditation for the clear light mind and the appearance of things, I hear a reference to appearance of thoughts.
Say again?
Appearance of thoughts. When thoughts appear in the clear light mind.
Right.
Okay,
so what that means is has to be understood, yeah.
So, but my question is, what would you say in regards to an overactive eye consciousness versus thoughts?
So one of the things I mentioned, like say for instance, I said, with respect to the body consciousness, I said, you may have a sense of the presence of the body, even though you're trying to concentrate, in your mental consciousness, as though you're, to use your word, you're fixated on the body consciousness, in the sense that the sense of the body is irrefutable there, and it's disturbing you, it's distracting you, you're focusing on that. I said,
eye consciousness.
Yes.
Okay.
Recognize that body consciousness appearance to your mind is just an appearance. You don't have to focus on it, and ask yourself the same way. What is the nature of the mind within which this body consciousness, or body sense of the body, is appearing? Again, same thing. Let go and sense the clear light nature within which that's appearing. Same thing with the eye consciousness. If there is, you know, your mental consciousness is being distracted by that, you can close your eyes for a little while. Sometimes if they're partially closed and you don't have a clear image, that can be more distracting. Slightly open so you see down the sides of your nose to a neutral area in front of you, just in front of your palms, rather than sort of halfway closed and this sort of some light coming in, but it's not clear. That can be a little bit distracting to me. So the instructions usually say closed, but enough that you can you're viewing a neutral area, like in my case there'd be my lower robe here, so it's just a neutral color. If it's something multicolored there, that might distract you. You know, if you have a nice scarf or something there, just something single color. And then withdraw your attention away from that first, like the turtle withdrawing its limbs. If that doesn't help, remind yourself that your mind, which is apprehending that, your mental consciousness is apprehending that, doesn't have to pay attention to that. It's like when Lama said, don't need unhappy mind. You don't have to entertain that. Take your attention away from the eye from what the eye consciousness is perceiving. It's a little bit like, you know, the example in a large building, there'll be in the basement a whole bunch of screens of all the surveillance cameras. Those cameras don't think, but there's a guy or gal in the basement who's looking at the cameras, seeing what's happening in case anyone's coming in without their pass or something like that, someone's stealing something. So the mental consciousness is like that person in the basement that does his own thing, but is also aware of what's happening at the other senses, you know, at the other surveillance cameras. The eye consciousness doesn't think, oh, that's a nice looking car. That's done by the mental consciousness. The eye consciousness is just passively receiving something. It itself is perceiving that, and the mental consciousness is aware of that, of everything that sense consciousnesses are. So to understand this process may help in divesting yourself from that. They are two things. If you can kind of turn down the intensity on the monitors, then the guy in the basement or gal in the basement can do their own thing. They can listen to the baseball game or do the crossword puzzle or whatever without being distracted by the monitors. So if you can turn down the intensity, you're not necessarily by, you know, not putting tape and, you know, closing your orifices, but through the process of concentrating on the mental consciousness, your attention will, the winds, the prana, upon which the eye consciousness depends, that those winds, when you wake up, first come up to your eye, allowing the consciousness to be in the presence of the eye organ, so that when an image appears on the retina near the eye faculty, then eye consciousness can arise. So if you can cause that eye consciousness, the wind, to just recede a little bit away from there. You're not like in tantric meditation where you cause it totally to absorb, or in the time of sleep when it comes very close to the heart chakra, the ear consciousness, all the consciousnesses absorb pretty much, you know, toward the heart chakra. At the time of death, they go completely. All of those gross consciousnesses first absorb before the gross mental consciousness disappears and you're left with the subtler mental consciousnesses. So in mimicking that, just even if through good concentration on the mental consciousness, the prana, which is the mount of the eye consciousness or ear or whatever, will begin to recede away from there, so you're not so, with some impetus outside, if something happens, the shadow falls into your field of view, maybe the wind comes closer to the eye and you see something, but it depends upon your concentration on the mental consciousness as your object. So it's an iterative process, fine-tuning, again and again experimenting in your own experience. And there's nothing wrong. you know, all of these experiences that you're talking about, darkness or, you know, being distracted by the senses, they're all normal occurrences. Not to worry about, just to remember, like the crow, sooner or later, even if you just sit there, but keep on trying to watch the mental consciousness, all these other things, there'll become a time when they subside again, and the eye consciousness is not so visible. But through my own experience, from the instructions about the seven-point posture of Vairochana, one of them is to focus your eyes down the side of your nose, toward the tip of your nose. It doesn't mean you have to look cross-eyed. You can just focus down there toward a neutral area around your lap, where your hands are at your navel, or a little in front of that. That might help a little bit. Okay. Okay. So now we're getting to a point in the text where on page I'm gonna use this as a bookmark, is that right? We have to end at 4:30. Do you remember where we were last time? What page? 125, right? So recognizing the ultimate reality of the mind. This is not the actual outline of this section, I think. As for the way to introduce the reality of the mind, I will record the oral instructions of my root guru. He is the pristine wisdom of all Buddhas, who assumed the aspect of a saffron-robed monk and removed the darkness from my confused mind. So Lhasa Trungpa Gelsen, the first Panchen Lama, is referring to his personal guru, who is named Sangye Yeshe, which is a little bit is embedded in the sentence. He doesn't say, my guru who is Sangye Yeshe. He's saying, he is the pristine wisdom, Yeshe, of all the Buddhas, Sangye. So like a lot of the long life prayers, you know, like for Lama Sopa Rinpoche, it doesn't say Lama Sopa Rinpoche. There's he whose patience is a Sopa, is this, you know, and who's guarded the teachings of the Muni, Tup, or the teachings, the Tempa, you know, so all of the words of his name are embedded in the sentence, but not saying, that's a way you can understand what those verses, who they're referring to, sort of like hidden in there. So he's kind of hidden the name of his root guru, Sangye Yeshe. He is the pristine wisdom of all the Buddhas who assumed the aspect of saffron-robed monk and removed the darkness from my confused mind. So we can think of that as our own gurus like that, whether they be ordained or not, male, female, even dog, who knows. Out of their kindness, out of the omniscient mind, manifesting in a form that we can recognize and to help to eliminate the darkness of my mind. So Patrick, you can think, you know, the darkness of your mind. From within that very state of earlier equipoise, so that means what we've been doing, trying to recognize the clear light nature of the mind, which we have not yet done. We're still working on that, but we're giving instruction. In previous times, maybe this further instruction wouldn't be given until you've actually had a good equipoise on the clear light nature of the mind. There's no longer doubt of what it was and all of these other things. We wouldn't get, but now it's in the tradition of many of the lamas, they said that in order to, and especially at a degenerate age, in order to prevent frustration, you know, like you never taught me anything more than perfect human rebirth. When are you going to teach me impermanence? When you realize perfect human rebirth, you know, this is completely frustrated. So here we're going to continue on. From within that very state of earlier equipoise, investigate intelligently with subtle awareness the essence of the individual who is meditating. So even though, as I said, this outline says recognize the ultimate reality of the mind, first we're going to try to recognize the ultimate reality, ultimate nature of the self. Yeah. What's the difference between the self and the mind? They're both subjects Do you know what I mean? Between subject and object, we say, "I see." Is it Jeff? We say, "Jeff, I see Jeff." They say, "My consciousness is perceiving Jeff." Is there a difference? Well, there's a difference. Almost, especially if you think you're trying to perceive the mind, it's like I am perceiving the mind. So the I is not recognized as identical to the mind, but they're both subjects. Like, for instance, in terms of agents, if you're cutting a tree, chopping a tree, the person who is wielding the axe is one of the agents of cutting. But the blade of the axe is also the direct instrument, also an agent of cutting. Primary, secondary agent, you might say. So, same thing here. Both the consciousness and the person are agents, you might say, are things that we're investigating here, but they're not identical. The sense of I is not exactly the sense of the consciousness, the perception of the consciousness. So even though we're going to be trying to eventually recognize the ultimate nature, the emptiness of the mental consciousness, the mind, we begin with something that's a little more subtle, a little more accessible, the sense of self, even though that is very difficult to identify. From within that very state of earlier equipoise, investigate intelligently with subtle awareness the essence of the individual who is meditating. Just like a small fish that moves in lucid waters without causing any disturbance. Remember the example I gave before? You know, development of tranquil abiding is like causing the pool of water after the horses have run through the pool of water. The surface becomes calm and the dirt, the mud, starts to settle and it becomes lucid and calm again, right? Following me? Then, that's kind of an analogy to developing tranquil abiding. The mind is not clouded by delusions and thoughts, and it is tranquil. It's not being disturbed. Actually, the two are related, because the emotions or the klesha that are like the dirt that are there cause the disturbance of the mind also. But say you like that pool of water, then you put in a little goldfish or a koi fish. Is that pronounced right? Koi fish. And at first, the example I gave before, I think several times, the jumping around in the water, the mud starts to come up again a little bit, the surface gets agitated. But if you were to be in control, you had some psychic power over that koi fish, like Yoda or something, you know, and just calm down, start to go slowly so the ripples are not created on the surface, and so there's not a lot of current below to bring up the mud, which is like causing the other conceptual thoughts to arise. That is likened to the development of what we call penetrative insight, vipassana. Vipassana, from a sutra point of view, generally, vipassana is always preceded by the attainment of shamatha, tranquil abiding. First you develop that perfect concentration, and then you have to train within that to analyze without causing disturbance. Usually the two are not present at the same time. When you do analytical meditation, you're not able to stabilize completely. When you can stabilize the mind, just hold one thing, you're not able to analyze because it's the opposite of stability. But it is possible, once you develop the stability, to train the mind to investigate. This, the little fish is kind of like the investigation, without disturbing the stability. But it takes a lot of effort. It's the development of vipassana. It doesn't take place just like that. You have to train in various stages. Okay? Understand? Just like a small fish that moves in lucid waters without causing any disturbance. Arya Nagarjuna himself stated, and this is from the Precious Garland, which you may have received teachings on, or certainly you can find the book's translation, first chapter, verses 80 and 81. The individual is not earth, is not water, is not fire, not wind, not space, not awareness, and it is not all of these. Yet, what individual is there other than these? Is that like an aha moment? Just as the individual is not real because it is composed of the six elements, likewise the elements themselves are not real because they are themselves composites. So this is meant to be beginning to give some reasonings for understanding the emptiness of the self. So how does this work? So it gets you wrapped in, if you happen to have access to this book, Echoes of Voidness, on page 135, Geshe-la says, generally speaking, there are two principal ways to approach voidness, emptiness. By understanding how things are mere conceptual imputations and thus inferring their void nature, which is what we're doing here in the Mahamudra, we'll see. A little bit different than the other, more what you may be more familiar with, by realizing how they are dependent events and thus inferring their void nature. So, for instance, one of the reasonings, which is similar to the other reasonings, was called the King of Reasonings. Do you know what that's called? The reasoning of what? Dependent arising. Once you've had an insight into emptiness and you understand the meaning of emptiness, simply understanding that phenomena arise because of various causes and conditions, in the case of compounded phenomena, or they depend upon their parts, imputation, basis of imputation, imputing mind, and the name that's given, in the case of all phenomena, including permanent phenomena. Using that reasoning, you can infer that they are empty of inherent existence because they're dependent arisings. So, rather than using the reasonings that are similar to that, which we usually find in the sutra teachings of Nagarjuna, let's say, and of the Majjhimika, here, I think in the Mahamudra, just as, remember we said one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Sutra Mahamudra, rather than developing experience on top of the view, First you get the view, then you have the experience first of tranquil abiding, then develop the view, differentiating. Also, I think here a little bit different. The reasoning that's used is more suitable for the Mahamudra experience rather than the usual way of things. So, generally speaking, there are two principal ways to approach voidness. By understanding how things are mere conceptual imputations, which we'll see here, and thus inferring their void nature. So if you know that phenomena are merely imputed upon a collection of parts, that there's no thing there, like say the person, if this is Adriana, no offense. If this is Adriana thinking, there's something there that's Adriana, trying to find something that's there, realizing, having searched within the various parts and without, you can't find anything which is Adriana, you come to understand that Adriana is just imputed conceptually upon that collection of parts and being satisfied with that. Where is Adriana? in North Carolina? Where in Raleigh? Where at Kadampa Center? Where? That's Adriana. But if you don't, you're not satisfied with just the name Adriana attributed to that, you want to say, what is Adriana? Is it her hair? Is it her brain? Is it her heart? Whatever, you know, where is Adriana? Something within the parts, the basis upon which you're conceptually calling Adriana, you won't find that. So by two ways to approach voidness, generally speaking, there are two principal ways to approach voidness. By understanding how things are mere conceptual imputations, having searched, can't find it, you realize that things are only labeled by mind and thus inferring their void nature. How does that mean? If it's just labeled, if Adriana is just labeled, if George is just labeled, if tree is just labeled, whatever, if mind is just labeled, that means there is no inherent nature within it, the basis of parts. So it's empty of that. So to infer emptiness or voidness, inferring their void nature by understanding how things are mere conceptual imputations. That's what we're going to be addressing here. And by the second way is realizing how they are dependent events and thus inferring their void nature. So that's not referring only to the king of reasonings, dependent arising, but, you know, the fact that phenomena are not inherently produced from self, not inherently produced from other, not inherently produced from both self and others, not inherently produced from no cause. All of these different reasonings all have a similarity there where you're understanding some dependence and understanding, and not necessarily this first method of first recognizing that they're conceptual imputations. So Geshe Rapton says, in this explanation of Mahamudra, we are following the first of those methods, that is, by understanding how things are mere conceptual imputations, thus inferring their void nature. Just as we have examined the nature of the self and found it to be non-inherently existent and merely an imputation, likewise we should consider all other phenomena. Anyway, so that's just to give some feeling for this. So what we're doing here, Nagarjuna says, the individual is not earth, is not water, is not fire, not wind, not space, not awareness, and not all of these. So why does he enumerate those things? What are those? Were there five or six? Six. What are they called? The six what? Six aggregates? No. Yeah, when we talk about the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, right? So sometimes we talk about five elements adding either consciousness or consciousness. Sometimes we talk about the six elements adding also space. But this space doesn't mean the absence of obstructing contact. It just means like the space of your stomach. The person is comprised of heat within the body, water or liquid, you know, fluid, cohesiveness, solidity, you know, the bones, the various parts of the body that have any solid nature, and motion, wind, prana, and also its function to move. All of those are fundamental components of the body. Also, within the body, there are places where there's none of those things. It's just cavities in your stomach when you haven't eaten. There'll be some space. Even when you've eaten, there's some space there. There's space within various parts of your body. So there's space, but it doesn't mean the absence of obstructing contact. It just means the ordinary sense of space, like there's a little bit of space at the top of this cup that's not completely filled, right? But in addition to that, there's also consciousness, all of its various varieties, primary consciousness, secondary mental factors, and so forth. So if you look within all those parts for the person, you start thinking, first of all, there is something called I, called me, called Robbie or Karen or whatever. Conventional. You're not necessarily talking about the word conventional I in its most precise form as merely imputed I. Here is just how the world considers you conventionally as Robbie Watkins or Karen, if I can pronounce your name, Mastrione. No? I asked why she didn't take the name Maklis when she got married. She said, if you had a name like Mastrione, you wouldn't give that up. Was it Marcello Mastrione, famous Italian actor, you know? So, so searching, you know, for what people consider you to be. You know, there's some conventional Robbie, some conventional George, some conventional Karen. It's that meaning of conventional here, not like from the point of view of the highest wisdom that sees that phenomena are just merely imputed, the mere conventional eye. This is just talking about the gross conventional eye. Follow? So in searching for that, is it your brain? You might think sometime someone in the morning, was it you or someone was saying, I have a feeling, you know, the mind was in the brain. We wasn't talking about the eye, but we might think the eye, the sense of eye is your body, especially in a gross sense, if someone says, you put on a few pounds there. You sort of grossly you identify with the body. Or if they, in the rare occurrence, they say, hey, you're looking pretty good. You might identify superficially with the body. There are instances like that when we identify with our form aggregate. There are times when we identify, say, with one of the mental factors, wisdom, say, or ignorance, say, you're a jerk. You know, and you're like, you're stupid. You know, we might actually, or we might criticize ourselves and think we're stupid, as though that is a basic component of I, or wisdom. You're smart, you know. But at the end of all those investigations, you recognize that that doesn't really satisfy. You can't find within those parts, the physical parts of the body, the five elements, the four elements of earth, water, air, and fire. None of those are the I, or suitable to be called I, not the cavities within the body, and not the consciousness. So you know that conventionally, we have feeling conventionally that you exist because you people say they mention your name, they recognize you, you have experiences and memories and so forth. So you have some conventional existence. So you're left when you investigate in that way with a dilemma: what is the I? As the fourth line here says in Nagarjuna stanza, yet what individual is there other than those? So you might think, oh, well, if the I is not any of these parts of the body, then it might be like some non-Buddhist theories or even Christianity, the I is something separate from the body and mind. Right? But if you think about that, if it were really separate from the body and mind, if you got bit by a mosquito or you cut your finger, you wouldn't say, oh, I hurt myself. We identify with the aggregates. It's as though the sense of I is not completely separate from the aggregates and can't be found within the aggregates. Do you follow what I mean? Many arguments like this you can read in the commentaries and in other treatises, but this just is a rough approach here. So one would come to the understanding then that the conventional self that exists, this gross conventional self, isn't inherently existing. There's no place that you can point. The sense of reality here, when it says, just as the individual is not real, that means it's not, can't be pointed at. Reality in that sense, inherently existent. Like the Dalai Lama says, the sense of the I, or the sense of anything that appears to us, to our uneducated mind, as though it has a reality that you can point to, you know, that you could find. Even though if I say, what is the clock, you might think it's, well, it's the things that have the numbers on it, but that's not the clock. That can't tell time without the battery and all of the other parts. Clock, in the end, is not separate from those parts, certainly, we can understand, but it's not findable in any of the parts as a basis that you could point to, that's the clock. Like the example I gave of the Lexus, you might think, it's the medallion, that's it, that says Lexus, or Mercedes, or Infiniti, or something like that. That's certainly not it. If you just say, I'm going to sell you my Lexus, and you just bring the person the medallion for $20,000, they're not going to be satisfied with that. That's not the Lexus. So what is the clock? You can come, same way in investigating the self, you can start to get an understanding that the self, other phenomena, the sense that we have that it's findable in the sense of pointing out, in having an inherent existence, that means without depending, that there's one thing that you can point to that is that, a basis that is the phenomena in question, that doesn't exist. Yet what individual is there other than these? Other than the six elements? In other words, there's no external self, none of these things are the basis for the self, so you start to understand there must be some other way the self is existing. The only way that can exist is just being satisfied when you arise from that analysis that the self is just the conception, just the name designated to that collection of parts. Just as the individual is not real, that means not inherently existent, that was sort of the first paragraph, it was talking about the self, the individual, emptiness of the self. Now the emptiness of phenomena. Just as the individual is not real, because it is composed of the six elements, and you can't find it in any of this, you can't find the self in any of the six elements, you can't find the self separate from the six elements, inherently existent as a findable thing. In the same way, likewise, the elements themselves are not real, are not inherently existent, because they themselves are composites, compounded. So it's a little bit like in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara is telling Shariputra, the bodhisattvas who meditate on emptiness, who striving in the perfection of wisdom, they meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also. Do you remember that from Samyukta Quest? So what that means is, from generally in the Theravadas, Shravakayana, Hinayana in general, the main emphasis is on the emptiness of the person. In fact, they don't even use the word emptiness. They just say selflessness, right? Anatma, or in Pali, anatta. Shariputra is questioning Avalokiteshvara, who's a bodhisattva. How do the bodhisattvas meditate on emptiness? Because I know how we, Shravakas, meditate on selflessness. What do you guys do? And Avalokiteshvara says, besides meditating on the selflessness of person, even the basis upon which you're imputing the person, that basis is also empty of inherent existence. Like, for instance, the example I gave of the forest. In a certain philosophical point of view, a forest is a mental construct. that you designate to a collection of trees. Without the trees, there's no forest. Right? Forest is just something you designate to that collection of trees. The same way that you designate, quote, an army to a collection of soldiers and cavalry and horses and armaments and so forth. Take away those parts and there's no army. Army is just army, forest, rosary. These are all examples of what in lower philosophical school we call imputedly existent, not substantially existent. But for the lower school, the trees themselves, the basis for designating the forest, each one of the intervals, they have some kind of substantial, it's not just like an imagination of the mind, they have some substantial existence. Same way for the lower schools, you've heard this several times now over the course of the last week or so mentioned. From the lower tenets, they believe the aggregates themselves have some substantial existence and that the person is merely designated like a forest onto these parts. But the parts exist, darn it. So Avalokiteshvara is saying, even the parts themselves, if you investigate, just like the tree, the higher philosophical schools say, actually the tree has parts too. Tree is just labeled onto that collection of parts. The limbs, the leaves, the flowers, the roots. There's no tree other than that. It's just labeled. And even those parts, if you analyze those, they're also, as far as you go, whatever degree of subtlety you go, they're all just merely imputed. So just as the individual is not real, just as, say, the self is not inherently existent, because it is composed of the six elements, likewise the elements themselves are not real. Just in the same way if you analyze the person in the aggregates, the same thing. The aggregates, the basis for designating the person, also have component parts. They're merely designated, merely imputed. There's nothing that inherently existent there. Likewise, the elements themselves are not real because they themselves are composite. When having investigated according to his statement, Nagarjuna's statement, you find that not even an atom of the equipoise, meditation, and the practitioner who enters equipoise, not even an atom of the equipoise and the practitioner who enters equipoise sustain a space like equipoise single-pointedly and without distraction. That particular translation of that verse, not completely clear to me. Let me see. Alex, this is another translation from Alex Berzin. That verse. Also here, when you search and like that, cannot find even a mere atom of total absorption, someone totally absorbed, and so on, then cultivate absorbed concentration on space-like voidness, single-pointedly, without any wavering. So this little section, because it's talking about the logic here in the Mahamudra to establish emptiness, not the traditional, although you can use certainly, as I'd mentioned before, you can definitely use within this calm state of mind the traditional method to recognize the object of negation and apply the usual logics. Here it's the logic seems to fit this particular Mahamudra practice. I'll read what the Dalai Lama says about this. So I'm not sure if the pagination here is in the same as in the book. I have a PDF here. Let me see. Is the same pagination? Maybe not. Maybe. No. Okay. Not the same pagination. So it says, refutation of the me, to be refuted. This is a Dalai Lama's book, not the one that's Lama Yeshe's book, right? Just, I mean, in case you were thinking you were trying to find it there. The text continues, just as our actual protector for refuge, the highly realized Arya Nagarjuna, has said, an individual is not Earth's, I'm just repeating, it's a different translation of the same root text, right? An individual is not Earth, not water, nor fire, nor wind, not space, not consciousness, nor is he or she all of them. So then commentary, Dalai Lama's commentary. If we examine what a person or me who feels happy or sad and utilizes things relies on in order to be imputed, you know, to be labeled Robbie or Karen or Kondro or whatever, what do you rely on to be labeled that? Maybe there's something there that is really findable that you can label it because it's really there. If we examine what a person or a me, quote unquote, who feels happy or sad and utilizes things relies upon in order to be imputed, we could say that the bodily elements of earth, water, fire, air, and space, in other words, the solid, liquid, heat, gas, and cavity constituents of the body. Although a person such as me does rely on these things, if we evaluate each of them through a process of elimination and ask, am I this body's solid constituents? You know, am I the bones or the tough part of the cartilage or, you know, fingernails or anything that's exemplification of the earth element? Am I this body's solid constituents? Nah. Am I its fluids? When you have to make a, very urgently, you have to go to the bathroom. Maybe you might identify with I had that just at the end of the last lecture. They were giving the appeal for funds, and I was identifying with the fluid. But that's in the end, you recognize that's not you. Am I the bodies? Am I the fluids? Or it's temperature? That means the heat and acidity, and so on. We can't find or identify this is me. But from another perspective, we can conventionally say that the location or place in which the I exists is a body and mind. So it's not as though the I exists somewhere else, you know, that my George's body is sitting on this chair and his mind is apparently around here because it's causing the speech, but George's person, the self of George, is somewhere else. That's not the case. We can conventionally say that the location or place in which the I exists is in a body and mind. This body and mind as a basis or location is where the I exists. I cannot be established as existing in some other location where the body and mind are not, such as in the table. Therefore, where I exist, is definitely somewhere in the body and mind. Although this is the case, if we scrutinize our aggregates, our parts, by a process of elimination, examining those factors upon which I is imputed, asking, am I this? Am I that? Am I the four bodily elements together or its cavities? Or if not, am I my body at all? Am I my mind? If you ask, scrutinize in this way, a basis with a defining characteristic of making it me or I is not in the slightest bit findable there within all these parts as the parts of the body, nor is it findable there as their collection of parts, the network or continuity. Likewise, in terms of being based on the mind, a basis with defining characteristic, making it me, is not in the slightest bit findable there as mind's continuity, its collections, or its parts. That is to say, you can't find a basis to say, that's the I within your mind. Mind is constantly changing. Of course, the I, we would say, I am also changing. But you can't find anything in the mind which you can say, that is me, that is I. A basis where you can designate it or say, that is the I. This is why Nagarjuna has said, a person is not earth, not water, not fire, nor wind, not space, not consciousness, nor is he or she all of them. The quotation of Nagarjuna cited in the text continues, yet what individual is there separate from these? So you might, we just addressed that a moment ago, but just with His Holiness's commentary to help again to understand. So you can't find a basis of this sense of I. So you're not yet thinking it's inherently existent or it's merely conventionally existent. You're just talking about what people conventionally say, Karen, Robbie, George, whatever. You're looking for that. You can't find a basis for that that you can point to within the body and mind. Now you think, well, maybe it's outside. Yet what individual is there separate from these? Although I am not the aggregates, there is not the slightest bit of a basis with a defining characteristic making it me that exists as a separate entity in a different package, in a different place from the body and mind, in the manner, for example, of the aggregates being possessions. You know, like there's an I out here who is the owner of the aggregates, which are its possessions. That's often how we think. You know, my body. You know, oh, my body is looking pretty good. My body is not looking so good. Yeah. Almost as though the I, the self, is the owner or possessor of the body and mind. But you can't point to, even though there's maybe a sense of that, you can't find anything like that separate from the body and mind. Although I am not the aggregates, there's not in the slightest bit a basis which has the characteristic which would make it me, make it a me that exists as a separate entity in a different package from the body and mind. You know, separate entity from the body and mind. In the manner, for example, of the aggregates being possessions, either individually or taken altogether, and that that me, that external me, is their possessor. A me cannot be found totally apart from these aggregates, nor can a me be found as something distinct from them, yet located in one of them, for instance, in the mind and so forth. If that's the case, where else could I be found? That's what said the import of Nagarjuna's statement. Furthermore, it is not that there is no me at all. There definitely is me. And here we're not talking about in the final philosophical analysis of merely imputed I, we just say a conventional I. There is a Laura. There is a Jill. Okay? Conventionally, we understand that. There definitely is a me who is helped and harmed, who collects karma and experiences its results. If for the reason that a me cannot be ultimately found, we say there is no me at all, this is contradicted by straightforward perception. And as the Dalai Lama says, anytime that actual evidence of, you know, experimentation and experience contradicts something, we should follow that. From straightforward perception and direct experience, it is well known in the world that there is a me. It's a person, me. From our own personal experience, we say, I am happy, I am sad. No one has to ask someone else for affirmation of this. although we do not know clearly where this me ultimately is, or what this me ultimately is, the existence of me is established from our own experience. Make sense? So we're going to, can't find it in the parts, yet there still is a me. That being so, and there being no findable basis, Alex is using this particular translation, with a defining characteristic making it me. There's nothing, no findable basis with the body, mind, or separate, with the characteristic that would define that is me, then what is called me is simply what can be labeled or imputed upon the basis of the collected bodily elements and so forth. Or using terminology when we can analyze the body not only into the six elements, into the five aggregates, there's no other person, there's no other me than that which can be labeled or imputed on the basis of the five aggregates. Imputed upon them. Just labeled. Simply labeled. Simply labeled has a profound meaning. Merely labeled. Have you heard that Geshe-la perhaps emphasizing the word merely? Merely labeled. Say, if you say labeled, you might think, well, the forest is labeled on the trees. The trees, collection of trees. The word merely, though, is not used in that context. The word merely implies that there is no other I other than that which is labeled. We say merely labeled. That excludes from consideration that there might still be some I there which is not the label, some basis that you could find if you search within the aggregates. Some of the lower philosophical schools in Buddhism, there's the assumption, even though the person is imputedly existent, imputed upon the five aggregates, still, if you look in the aggregates, there's something which is an exemplification of the I, an instance of the I, like the continuation of the mental consciousness or something else. But the word merely imputed or simply imputed, simply what can be labeled or imputed upon the basis of them, is excluding that. It means all, what was it, Alex is all Sandra or Zandra? Can I say Zandra? Yeah, Sandra. Alexandra. I like it. That's, you know, sometimes comes the shock. Alex, you're just a name. And you might feel that doesn't satisfy. It seems like there is some Alex there within your own mind. And we also feel there's something not just a name. In the Prajnaparamita Sutras, many times, in many of the sutras, Buddhists, like in the Vajracetaka, the Vajrakara Sutra, the Buddha said, Bodhisattva is just a name. Anyone who thinks, I am a Bodhisattva, and the implication here means not just I am merely imputed Bodhisattva, but I am a Bodhisattva, is coursing in the wrong way, as misconception. You know, trying to fine-tune the perception of identity. So it's mentioned again in the sutras. It doesn't mean that Hemat, if I remember the correct phrase, is only the sound of those words. That's not the meaning. It means that those giving that label, either verbally written or just conceptually thinking Hemant, that's the most that we can say that the person conventionally exists. In what sense? That's what we can identify, some continuum which has that characteristic of being Hemant or Robbie or Sandra or Jill or whatever. Just that name is given to that. There's nothing findable within those parts or apart from those parts, separate from those parts, that would be an inherently existent, something different than the mere name. So the mere name, the mere label, is, if that's how we exist, that's radically different than how our mind perceives things. Because of that, a me, self, is not something the existence of which is established by its own power. How is someone's existence established? Well, cooperatively, dependently, upon a basis of designation, Venerable's aggregates, Venerable's motion, walking out of the coma, no, I'm just saying, her mind and so forth. Because of that, a me is not something the existence of which is established by its own power, by virtue of itself, without relying on such a basis. The sense that we have, though, the primordial ignorance that fuels all our delusions, is one that goes along with the appearance that there is something there behind the reflection. Remember the example I've given several times in the hotel glass door, seeing out of the peripheral vision someone in saffron robes thinking, oh, there's another monk, and seeing that there was none there at all. Right? It is not something the existence of which is established by virtue of an inherent nature. There is no inherent self-nature findable on the side of me that establishes, proves, or empowers my existence and makes me me. So when you sense that in your own mind, if you're doing confession and you remember, I did this and I did that, to realize emptiness at that time helps in the purification process. There was never an I that existed at that time, even though my mind was believing it. It's like in a dream or at the cinema, crying because Brad Pitt has just been speared by the, what was he in the?
Trojan,
yeah. He was, who did he play?
Achilles
or something. You know, he go, oh, Brad, there was no... It's just, you know, it's just like a cinema, you know. So, and sometimes, I remember Kirti Senchab Rinpoche, one of our incredible, profound gurus, said that even watching the cinema, you can be, use that to meditate on emptiness. You know, watch how you get involved in that and then go back. See, this is just a projection. It's completely devoid of the reality that you might get involved in. Of course, no one's going to say, oh, it was really Brad Pitt died or something. But in that moment, you're buying into that, right? The I is not something the existence of which is established by virtue of an inherent self-nature. There is no inherent self-nature findable on the side of me that establishes, proves, or empowers my existence and makes me me. In this sense, a me is not something truly and inherently existent. That being the case, except for a me as an individual person who feels happy or sad and utilizes things, being simply that to which a mental label refers, on the foundation of a basis for labeling me, a me cannot be at all established as existing independently of its own accord. So other than merely being labeled, there's no other I, as our mind has believed since beginningless time. Do we end at 4 or 4:30? 4:30. Why don't we take a 10-minute break? I'm beginning to identify with the fluid element again. I'll continue reading the Dalai Lama's commentary on this verse by Nagarjuna, which we've looked at it from Geshe Rapton's point of view, from Amayeshi's point of view, from the translation's point of view. So the quotation of Nagarjuna concludes, And just as an individual is not perfectly existent, is not inherently existent, because he or she is what can be labeled on a conglomeration of six constituents, likewise, none of the constituents are perfectly existent, truly existent, inherently existent, because each is what can be labeled on to a collection of parts. We talked about this before, so just different, the way that the words are translated in English may just sound a little bit different, but we just mentioned that the last hour or so. The me, or the I, the self, that is the collector of karma for happiness or suffering, the one that experiences its results and feels happy or sad, is simply what can be labeled on the basis of a collection or network of causes and circumstances. Like Kemet was asking, question comes up, what transmigrates or what reincarnates, what leaves this body? There is a self, but it's just that which is labeled on the mere wind and mind, the subtlemost wind and mind when we die. Our gross consciousness absorbs. We leave this gross aggregate, but there's something that is similar to a form aggregate. We say the prana upon which the subtlemost mind resides, depends, rides, that leaves this body and immediately becomes slightly grosser, becomes a bardo, intermediate state, mind and body, which is a little bit grosser than that, but so that clear light mind and wind we can label an I. It's no longer called Hemet or Jill or who might die soon. No, I'm just joking. Yeah. No longer labeled Herb or George. How old do you know?
83.
83. Okay, a couple of years older than I am. 74. So, and you should know that Judy is my younger sister. I said this morning, some people thought, oh, it's your sister. I don't mean biological, genetic sister. She was born August 7th, 1945. I was born July 23rd, so I'm 2 weeks older than her, so she's my younger sister. Okay? My name. So in all of these instances, wherever from now until enlightenment, there always is a basis to impute, merely designate, a self. It will no longer have the name that we have this lifetime. Once Herb leaves this body and gross consciousness, that subtlemost consciousness, which still carries karmic imprints from this life and previous lifetimes, and the wind, which acts as its mount, that's like a body, and subtle mind, goes into the intermediate state. That intermediate state body will eventually die when you take rebirth in one of the six realms, or if you take rebirth in the pure realm, in a pure land. There's always a basis for labeling, but never findable, a soul or an inherently existent person who has gone from here to there. Do the aggregates? His ways of translating here. Do the aggregates stimulators of cognition? I think that means the ayatanas, and the cognitive sources, which means the dhatus. These are three categories. Have you heard of that? When we talk about all impermanent phenomena can be included in the five aggregates. Have you ever heard that? You might think the five aggregates just refer to a human. But all impermanent phenomena can be included amongst the form aggregate. I mean, all forms are in the form aggregate, not just your own body, doors, trees, bones. And then, of course, the feelings of all sentient beings, the discriminations, compositional factors, consciousness, all impermanent phenomena can be found in those five aggregates. All phenomena can be found within what are called the 12 entrances or 12 ayatanas. Have you heard of that, Keche? Here he's translating as stimulators of cognition, sometimes Keche. That which gives rise to cognition. That means the six senses, six sense faculties, and the six objects of those. Because when they come in contact, consciousness can arise. He's calling stimulators of cognition. All phenomena can be found in those 12 entrances. All phenomena can be found within the 18 dhatu. Have you heard of, there's a Dharma center, it's called Dharma Dhatu, or maybe you've heard the word Dharma Dhatu refers to the ultimate nature of reality. So there's the eye faculty dhatu, nose faculty, ear faculty dhatu, so forth, which are like the six faculties. And then the objects of those are called, in that context, they're called six dhatus. And then the consciousnesses themselves that are derived from those 12 are called dhatus. The objects of mental consciousness, all phenomena are the objects of mental consciousness, but the exclusive objects of mental consciousness, like emptiness, you don't see emptiness, hear, smell, taste, impermanence, things that only the mind can perceive, those are called dharma dhatu. Okay. Just as the me is what can be labeled by depending on the basis of a network of six constituents of earth and so forth, likewise, each of these six constituents, or the five aggregates, depends for its existence upon the basis of its parts and what is collected under its rubric, such as everything solid being included in the constituent element of earth. Thus, its existence can only be established by relying on or depending on upon factors other than itself. Things are dependently arising. They depend on their collection of parts, a label that's given to them, and the labeling mind. Okay. So I think what we've been doing is worthwhile going into a little bit of detail about this, but from this point I'm just going to more or less read with minimal commentary in order to create some dependent arising of finishing the text, and then begin to read the text again, just the first couple of lines, set up some, what we say, dependent arising to teach again. I have a. If you go to the web, you can find on Alex Berzin's website and on some other websites most of the book as kind of PDF. The page, as I was checking before, it's not the same pagination as this, but the words are the same, I believe. I wasn't sure about the grammar. Sometime maybe they typed it in and they left off S when there should be a plural or something. I'm not sure. Yeah, so that's the commentary of the Dalai Lama on that verse. So when having investigated according to his statement, that is Nagarjuna's statement, you find not even an atom of the equipoise and the practitioner who enters equipoise, not even an atom of that sustains a space like equipoise, single-pointedly and without sustain a single-pointed equipoise single-pointedly and without distraction. I think, I'm not sure what her translation was here. This is done by Vola. Moreover, from within the state of equipoise, various objects appear and proliferate in this non-obstructing vacuity that is not established as a material form, or you could say is established as not material. So what does that mean? Within, it's a symbol, within that equipoise and the clear light nature of mind, sometimes thoughts will arise, and because of your mind paying a little bit of attention to it, you will draw some conclusion, associations, another thought arises, proliferations, elaborations, mental elaborations. recognizing this non-obstructing, recognize this non-obstructing continuum, the mind that engages continuously, recognize it as clear and knowing. The conceiving mind appears not to rely on anything else. So now we're getting, just previously, this is such a short thing, talking about all of the investigation of the to establish the selflessness of the person that could be elaborated in great detail, as this is what's called a root text. So it's just from that root text, like when you build a stone wall in the, at least in India or in Nepal and in Tibet, it has a certain stability but can be, you know, not completely stable. If you put between the stones some mortar, mud or mortar, it has greater stability. So like that, having heard a commentary, when you hear these words, it's like the words are like the root text is like the stones, and the commentary is like the mortar. They're dependent upon one another. If you remember these, if you read these words, they can bring back your understanding of the commentary of those words. And even remembering the meaning, you can sometimes recall the words of the, you know, like sometimes the Lama will be saying, well, we're talking about this or that, like bodhicitta, and then you know that bodhicitta is for the welfare of sentient beings to aim for enlightenment, and the verse comes up, Temke Pani Shendon Chir, Yang Dag Zokpe Jang Shub De. You'll find the Lamas, you know, thinking for a minute, and it thinking of the meaning, like the mortar, can help you to recall the words. So this is just a root text. So very, now we're talking about the emptiness of the mind. Recognize this non-obstructing continuum, the mind that engages continuously is clear and knowing. The conceiving mind appears not to rely on anything else. And as for it, the objects it apprehends, well, let's say it was set with that first thing. The mind appears to be not rely on anything else. It's like the, it's doing something, you know. And if you start to recognize that has that sense of inherent existence, like it's something you could point to, there must be some, the mind thinks there must be some basis, either its parts or apart from its parts, which is the mind that you could point to that is the mind. The same way when we talked about the self. Right? You understand? I forget your name. Yeah. Elise. Okay. I was going to say David's wife. Right? Or David is Elise's husband. Yeah. The conceiving mind appears not to rely on anything else, and as for objects it apprehends, the great saint Shantideva has stated in the Bodhisattvacharyavatara, if you're looking for this in the 8th chapter, verse 101, what is called a continuum or a collection is a falsity. In the same way as our a mala, rosary, an army, a forest, and so on. So we talked to again before. Why are they false? It's not that they're false, it's that there's an understanding, a misapprehension in the mind that there's something substantial out there, like a forest, or there's something substantial that's a rosary. Rosary is just a name we give to the collection of parts. Even the lower tenets accept that. But they accept the beads are substantially existent. But we would say, even the beads themselves, if you analyze, they are comprised of parts. And even those little slivers of wood or whatever, or pearl or glass or whatever, they are comprised of molecules. Those molecules are comprised of atoms and so forth. Everything is merely, that there is nothing that you can find which is a basis for what our mind misapprehends, some kind of inherent existence out there. So this famous verse from the Bodhisattvacharyavatara, what is called a continuum or a collection is a falsity in the same way as our amala, an army, and so on. relying on scriptures and logic, enter single-pointed equipoise in the state where things do not exist in the way that they appear. In teaching over the years about emptiness, Lama Zopa has mentioned there is no way that you can really understand emptiness deeply without relying on the great commentators, the great commentaries by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and these great beings. So we need to rely on the, what do you say? Scriptures and logic. Scripture and logic. So we need to rely on the scriptures and even scriptural citations sometimes in your meditation, like this, some quotation from Shantideva, to bring about, and also logic. Logic alone is not enough. Sometimes you need to have some statement that sort of exemplifies the conclusion of that logic. Relying on scriptures and logic, enter single-pointed equipoise on the state where things do not exist in the way that they appear. So kind of like on the emptiness of all phenomena, knowing that no phenomena can be found to have any basis where you can say that that phenomena actually exists. In brief, as my spiritual teacher, Sangye Yeshe, which was inferred in that previous verse, who understood everything in accordance with reality, as in accordance with what he said, brief, quote, when you fully understand that whatever dawns in your mind is apprehended conceptually, the sphere of ultimate reality will dawn without you needing to rely on anything else. Once you place your mind in the knowledge of that dawning, dwell on it in single-pointed equipoise. And there's some statement of how amazing at the end. So he isn't like that. Wow. No. Similar to this statement, Padampa Sangye, who was a great saint who came, I think I mentioned yesterday, I think he brought the Chö practice to Tibet, often associated with a village that he visited often in Dingri. And many of his verses, as this one mentioned, the people of Dingri, so, oh, people of Dingri, this, here it says, people of Dingri, make the lance of awareness twirl within the empty state. The view is unimpeded and unobstructed. These instructions converge to the same point. I'm not going to elaborate about that, maybe, otherwise we won't finish. Conclusion, dedication. Afterward, dedicate whatever positive roots of virtue were created from having meditated on Mahamudra, along with the ocean of your virtue collected in the past, present, and future, toward unsurpassable great enlightenment. How can you dedicate, let's say, your past virtues have left karmic seeds on your mind stream. If they have not ripened, they still can be dedicated because they're yet to be experienced. It's like capital, right? Some bond you don't have the cash here, but negotiable bond or something, right? How about your future? Can you say you're going to dedicate your future earnings? Yeah, you can. You may not have any future earnings, but here we even dedicate our future karma. Future virtuous actions, everything we've done in the past, everything that we will do in the future, even if our mind becomes distracted, may all of that go toward the achievement of unsurpassable great enlightenment. Here, great enlightenment means not only our own enlightenment, but by inference, that means by our achieving enlightenment that brings about the Mahayana goal of the enlightenment of all sentient beings. So sometimes they say, I dedicate my marriage to the great enlightenment. It doesn't mean like my enlightenment is the great enlightenment. It means that by my becoming enlightened, I can enlighten all other sentient beings. In that sense, in the sense of Mahayana or mahasattva. Having cultivated your mind in this way, whenever you investigate in great detail the way any object of the six consciousnesses appear, any object appears, the way it exists will dawn nakedly and vividly. Recognize whatever arises in your mind. In brief, do not grasp at the inherent existence of whatever object appears, such as your mind and so on, and always sustain with certainty the way they exist. That is, always try to keep a continuum of understanding that phenomena are merely designated, that what appears to us now is so real and important is just the appearance of our karma, dependent arising, and consistent. There will be pleasant appearances depending on creation of good karma in the past. Unpleasant appearances, discordant appearances that cause us uncomfortable, being beaten or bitten or hearing harsh words or whatever due to bad speech in the past. Recognize that, you know, within the sphere of emptiness, this is just, all of this is appearing. All of it is merely labeled and doesn't have the reality that our mind is attributing to it, that you know, causes you to cry when Brad gets speared, right? Geshe Repton was mentioning something like, if you have jaundice, not only does your skin and eyes become yellow, but sometimes it can affect your body, so certain things look yellow outside. When I had jaundice, I didn't notice that so much myself, but apparently that can happen. Anyone nursing, is that true? Yeah. So he gave an example of skiing, snow slopes. Then you can, even though you have jaundice and what appears is not exact, the snow is not yellow, still, you can still ski, you know. Still, you can, even though you understand phenomena are empty of inherent existence, that like this appearance of true existence is not really there, still you can navigate through the conventional appearances. Understanding your Buddha nature, empty of inherent existence, all phenomena are empty of inherent existence, gives you, and as you arise from that again, seeing these as illusion-like, mirage-like, try to recall what that means, that there's not some kind of importance that our mind is attributing to things as though they existed from their own side. They still function, but ultimately what instigates the delusions is the sense of inherent existence, predominantly the sense of a self-identity. Once you recognize that that doesn't exist, the afflictions will be much less prominent, and as you have realization, they can eventually be abandoned by seeing reality directly. In brief, do not grasp at inherent existence of whatever object appears, such as your mind and so on, and always sustain with certainty the way they do exist. With such understanding, all phenomena in samsara and nirvana are reunited in the single essence. So, is single essence? It means samsara and nirvana are the same? Well, they're the same in that their ultimate nature is the same. Even nirvana, even Buddhahood, is empty of inherent existence. We might think, oh, when I get there, that's a real goal, you know, real state, or the Buddha is real. Aryadeva confirms this by explaining in his famous text, the 400 verses, whoever sees one entity sees all entities. Whatever is the emptiness of one is the emptiness of all. I alluded to this the other day, and I said, when you're recognizing the emptiness of the self, what appears is a mere vacuity, right? There's no thought, this is the emptiness. At that point, there's no thought, this is the emptiness of the self. or if you meditate on the emptiness of form or feelings or whatever, a mere vacuity appears which is has exactly the same import, mere negation of inherent existence. It's only in the subsequent meditation, when you arise from that, that you have a knowledge that you've realized the emptiness of that particular phenomenon. So when you, in that meditative equipoise, the emptiness, what is the emptiness of one is the emptiness of all. So even though you don't, you have, if you've recognized the emptiness of the self, you haven't recognized the emptiness of all phenomena, you're not perceiving all phenomena, still, what you've recognized is the same emptiness, the same quality of emptiness of all phenomena. The mind that is properly placed in equipoise on reality is indeed completely free from elaborations with respect to samsara and nirvana, such as existence, non-existence, and so on. So what does that mean? Free from elaborations. Have you ever heard that expression? Sometimes you see in the philosophical text. What it means that the mind is thinking that maybe when the Buddha passes away, is he reborn? Or disappear? Is he not, does he not exist? All of these things, philosophical ramifications of the mind, are called elaborations of thought. So these various kinds of elaborations about all of these different topics, when the mind that is properly placed in equipoise on reality, the ultimate nature of reality, is indeed completely free from elaborations. There's no thinking about samsara and nirvana, existence and non-existence, and so on. Once you've risen from that equipoise, when you investigate, you see that although agents, actions, and dependent originations exist, merely through being imputed with a name, they still undeniably appear like a dream, a visual distortion, a moon's reflection on water, and a mirage. These other examples also, like an echo, like a magical illusion, and so forth. Agents, actions, dependent originations. When, for you, appearances do not obscure emptiness, that is to say, when you apprehend conventionally appearances, that doesn't prevent your mind from understanding that they're empty of inherent existence. Right now, when we perceive appearances, there's no doubt to us that we really believe they're really there, inherently existent. But when you reach the point when the appearances no longer prevent you from understanding that they're empty, when for you appearances do not obscure emptiness, and emptiness does not obscure appearances, what does that mean? Or obstruct appearance, the existence of appearances. So when you realize emptiness, at that point, even if you have an intellectual understanding of that, you have an intellectual understanding of emptiness, still knowing that, that does not prevent you, is not an obstacle in your mind to believe that appearances can appear. Like, you can fall thinking erroneously about emptiness. You can think that phenomena don't exist at all, like misinterpreting the Heart Sutra. In emptiness, there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, and so forth. And so they don't exist at all. That's an extreme. Also, when you see the appearances, you can think, oh, they can't be empty because they're appearing inherently existent. When for you appearances do not obscure emptiness and emptiness does not obscure appearances, the noble path of emptiness and dependent origination, having the same meaning, will manifest. Are emptiness and dependent origination and trend arising, are they synonyms? Huh? You're careful there. You were, I thought you were nodding. No, you guys are smart. Yeah, I think that's probably right. Like one implies the other. The part of the one entity, just like conventional truth and ultimate truth, when we talked in the Heart Sutra. A conventional truth is not an ultimate truth. An ultimate truth is not a conventional truth, generally speaking. Although you can understand emptiness conceptually, and in which case you have a mental image of emptiness, but still, emptiness itself, ultimate truth, and conventional truth. If one thing cannot be both a conventional truth and an ultimate truth. Yet, one thing, let's say a form, conventional form, has an ultimate nature. Every phenomena has two natures. Its conventional nature and its ultimate nature. In the same way here, when we're talking about appearances of, you know, that appear to our mind when we rise from meditation, and the appearance of vacuity, of emptiness, when we're in meditative equipoise, they don't contradict one another. They're like the two sides of a coin also. Then the final colophon and dedication. These words were written by the renunciate Losang Chukyi Gelsen, who has heard many teachings. I remember mentioning in Washington that when the Dalai Lama mentions about himself, he just calls himself this Shakya Bhikshu Tenzin Gyatso. It doesn't say, the great Dalai Lama, but ordained people shouldn't really refer to themselves in their letters. They sign Venerable George. You don't sign your letter Venerable George. Someone else might call you Venerable. You don't call yourself Venerable like that. So here, one of the things that can be legitimately said without hubris is to say, who's heard much teaching. You know, it doesn't mean I've understood anything. At least I've heard teachings, and maybe for that reason, if you haven't heard anything, you might listen to what I say. These words were written by the renunciate Losang Chukyi Gelsen, who has heard many teachings. Through this merit of composing this and so forth, may all wandering beings quickly become conquerors through this path that has only one door to liberation. Oh, again, one door to liberation? You know, remember I said in the Satipatthana Sutra, it says the one door to liberation is achieve, you know, what is it called? Smriti Adhisthana. In Pali, you say Satipatthana. That means close placement of the of mindfulness on the breathing, close placement of mindfulness. I say, it says that's the one door to liberation. Sometimes it says in the Vipassana Sutra, Vipassana is the one door to liberation. Bodhicitta is the one door to liberation. So here it's saying the one door to liberation. So there are always there's many doors you have to pass through. It's like, there's no contradiction by saying all of these are the one door you have to pass through, because you have to pass through each one of them. You can't go, once you go through this door, you can't go over somewhere else. It's another way. You have to develop single-pointed concentration, wisdom of emptiness, bodhicitta, and so forth. Having seen that the eight worldly concerns are like the drama of lunatics, oh, I love that. You know what the eight worldly concerns are? Usually we call it the eight worldly dharmas. What are the eight worldly dharmas? You know? Who can I ask? No, you guys know. I would say someone who might know and just... What are the eight worldly... Okay. Bill, do you know the eight worldly dharmas? Oh. Sometimes it's good to go back because... Shantideva in his previous life, Shantideva, who wrote the Bodhisattvacharya Vatara, Milarepa, sorry, who achieved enlightenment in his next lifetime. Previous lifetime, he was a disciple of Atisha, Kadampa Geshe, And one thing that he was supposedly recited all the time that lifetime, he had not yet developed renunciation, bodhicitta, or wisdom of emptiness. He recited, the eight worldly dharmas, or eight worldly concerns, are not objects of a yogi such as I. You know, to remind himself not to get involved in the eight worldly dharmas, to pollute our virtuous actions with concern for pleasure of the senses, or for gain, financial gain, or for fame, or for respect, and so forth. That's the basis of the practice. So if our practice, and the last verse of the eight verses of training the mind, how's it, do you know, you haven't memorized? You recited the other? With none of these actions defiled by stains of the eight worldly dharmas, by seeing all dharmas as illusory, all phenomena as illusory, maybe I'm freed from the bondage of attachment, something like that. So even there, reminding, even when you're doing these high meditations, bodhicitta and meditation on emptiness, to make sure that our actions are not compromised because we're doing it with some intention of happiness for this life alone. So it's good to go back over those. Having seen that the eight worldly concerns are like the drama of lunatics, Gendan Gyaltsen, this is one of the petitioners who asked him to write this text. Gendan Gyaltsen, with the degree of the 10 fields of knowledge, and another monk, Sherab Senge from Hartong, with the degree of the 10 difficult subjects, they live according to the conduct of rishis. Remember when we talked about rishis before? Like Maharishi, someone who's very, very careful in their actions, especially their speech, live according to the conduct of rishis in isolated mountain valleys and take this path as the essence of their practice. They had already urged me many times to introduce Mahamudra in this way. In particular, the great Ansapa himself, the omniscient conqueror and lord of masters with attainments, has said, and this is referring to one of the lineage lamas from, remember, Lama Tsongkhapa heard, received the lineage, long lineage of the Mahamudra from the Kargyu lamas that came from Saraha and Tilopa and Naitripa and so forth, but he also heard directly from Manjushri, a short lineage. So that lineage, the Gelugpa oral tradition, went from Lama Tsongkhapa to his disciple over several disciples till the time of the first Panchen Lama, subsequently labeled the fourth Panchen Lama. One of the previous lineage lamas of that was Ansapa, the one who achieved enlightenment in his luxurious lama apartments in the monastery. Remember I told you the story of the nun who built a nice three-year retreat place, and Lama had her paint a picture of Ansapa, had it commissioned on the outside of the building so the Tibetans wouldn't think, oh, these Injis, they just have toasters, and, you know, all the real meditators, they sleep on the rocks or whatever. So, in particular, the great Ansapa himself, the omniscient conqueror and lord of masters with attainments, has said, I've written an explanation similar to the Lamrim of the Kadampas, starting from the proper way to rely on the spiritual master up to calm abiding and insight in a song of realizations as advice for myself and others, without including at the end this path that has just been explained. I am not able to write down the ultimate instruction of Mahamudra that is not well known in the land of snows. So at that time, when Ansapa was writing other texts, he alluded to the Mahamudra lineage, but he said he wasn't able to write that down. Not because he couldn't, he didn't know, because it wasn't the right time. So the Panchen Lama says, what was not written down at that time, due to restrictions, was intended for a later time, namely now, when he wrote this. This is understood by an assertion that is established, for example, by the statement in the Lotus Sutra. Since it is an object to be thoroughly realized by the pristine wisdom of the Buddha, never tell those who take it upon themselves to write of this method that you are enlightened. Why? Because those who act as our refuge take timing into consideration. So just the same thing with the Lojong teachings. They were not that came from Atisha, training of the mind. They were not initially exposed publicly. It wasn't until several generations later, having heard those teachings through ear-whispered lineage, that the time was right to expose them. So this is a general kind of thing, something that you don't hear now. If Geshe-la doesn't teach something, you will hear it later. I remember Serkan Rinpoche would say, you know, what one Buddha doesn't teach, the next Buddha will. So don't feel that, Geshe-la left out this. So finishing, I, Losan Chukyi Gelson, who upholds the immaculate instruction of Sutra and Tantra, and the undefiled stream of blessings of those who actually practice this path, have also become part of this lineage, starting from the unparalleled teacher, the king of the Shakyas, Shakyamuni Buddha, all the way down to my own root guru, Sangye Yeshe, who knows everything and sees everything. Without introducing impurities of samaya, what does samaya mean? Commitments, you know, that you have taken on. Without introducing impurities of samaya, I composed this text in Ganden Nampur Gyalwe Ling. That's the end of the text. So, didn't go into detail about everything, but I'm going to just read a little bit of the beginning for auspiciousness. Highway of the Conquerors, the Mahamudra root text of the precious Genden oral tradition by the first Panchen Lama Losan Chukyi Gelsen. Namo Mahamudraya, homage to Mahamudra, the all-pervasive nature of everything. I bow with respect at the feet of the incomparable Guru, the Lord of Siddhas, who teaches the naked state of reality, the indivisible and inexpressible sphere of the Vajra mind. Having condensed the essence of the ocean of sutric and tantric advice, I will write down the instructions of the Genden oral tradition of Mahamudra, of the supreme Siddha Dharmavajra, and his followers who give sound instruction. There are three parts: preparation, actual practice, and conclusion. The preparation begins, first earnestly go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, since these are the gateway and central pillar of the teachings, and especially the Mahayana, they should not be mere words. So oftentimes when His Holiness has the leisure to finish a text, you again read the beginning verses of the text, leaving it there as though unfinished, so auspiciousness to again continue with teachings again. So this is kind of like our primer coat, Mahamudra, for some of you. Some of you have heard, studied Mahamudra before. If I've introduced any errors, I request the forgiveness of the omniscient mind and your holy minds. Hopefully not anything. One of my teachers, Geshe Tekchok, much wiser than myself, he would say, you know, I might make some small mistakes once in a while. This is what he was saying. I may make some small mistakes once in a while, but I never make a whopper. Herb studied a long time with Geshe Tekchok, very close. He was the abbot of Sarah for a long time. He was the teacher at Nalanda for the Western monks and very great teacher. Of course, he didn't say that in English. His translator, I think it was Tenzin, can't remember. Steve translated that verse? Okay. I may make some little thing might be wrong, but I'll never make a whopper. I don't know what Steve, I'll have to ask Steve. I chat with him often. I'll have to ask him what the Tibetan was for whopper, in case you want a big whopper. So we just have a couple of minutes. Let's end in a little bit of rehearsal again of our meditation on the Mahamudra. We've already done the 9-round breathing meditation at the beginning. Sit comfortably. Relax your body after this long sitting. Let go of the tension. Relax your mind. And like the example of the tortoise, withdraw your attention away from the senses to just your mental consciousness. Whatever is present, whether it is already a remembering consciousness of clarity, or if it's darkness, or a succession of thoughts, or something unclear like wavering or rippling or whatever, try to let go of that and sense the unobstructing nature of the mind, its clear light nature, within which that appearance is arising. Take some effort, take some concentration. Even if you inadvertently start to construct something that you think is the clear light nature of the mind, like imagining it like sky or space or something, let go of that and try to sense the actual unobstructing nature of the mind within which acts as the basis for that appearance. You might feel like you're multitasking in this sense, that one part of your mind has a feeling you might be sensing that all-pervasive clarity of the mind, but part of your mind also is delving into the various appearances on the surface. So squeeze a little bit to exclude the appearances other than just the clear light nature of your mind. And the understanding of that. If you're just on the periphery of that experience, it might seem that it's a small little object, the clarity of the mind. Involve yourself in there as though it expands and fills all space. Your body. and within that clarity, for a moment, investigate how you exist. In a conventional sense, the world has a name for me. It calls me George or Fred or Herb or Dave. So there is some conventional sense of the self that seems to be located on the basis of the body and mind. It can't be found other than that. But I can't find any basis within the aggregates or the elements of body and mind that can be pointed to as that conventional I, as though it existed from its own side. From what we've mentioned before, if you recall from your own thinking before, one comes to the conclusion that the I that does exist, the conventional I, is merely labeled onto this collection of parts. It can't be found in the parts, the collection of parts. It can't be found apart, separate from the parts. It's just a name given to this collection of parts. And therefore, I that's labeled, is empty of existing from its own side, because although it exists, it's not existing from its own side. It's dependent upon the parts, the basis of the designation, the name that we give to it, me or self or George or whatever, and to the mind that gives that name to those parts. The dependent arising, empty of inherent existence. See if you can have a feeling of vacuity, the self that you've believed in since beginningless time, particularly this lifetime, because we don't remember the continuum of ignorance in previous lives. The I that you recall, that you're proud of, football game or tennis match you won, or the chess match, or besting someone else, or the humility you felt, low self-esteem, that I that was so apparent at those times never existed, doesn't exist now, didn't exist before, will never exist, because the I is empty of inherent existence. In the same way, the mind itself, the clear light nature of the mind that we've been investigating, even though we may not have a clear picture of it yet, we have some general understanding, some little experience of it, that also seems to our mind, without investigation, as findable there. Somehow, in the background, without analysis, it seems to exist from its own side. But like the self, like the rosary, the forest, the army, or any continuum, it's just a name labeled to those parts. There's no contradiction between the mind conventionally existing, appearing, having its own causal continuity. No contradiction between that and it being empty of the import that we imagine within it, the conceived object of inherent existence. Merely imputed, therefore empty of inherent existence. So think, with that understanding, I can develop all of the good qualities, I can purify all of the stains from the mind. With this armor, I'm going to work this lifetime, future lifetimes, to become a better person for the sake of others, with the intention of not stopping just becoming a little bit better, but to actually achieve my highest potential, full enlightenment. To alleviate the darkness from the minds of all sentient beings, lead them to a state of enlightenment. Due to the merits that we've created today, in the past, and even the merits we'll create in the future, may I quickly become fully enlightened Buddha, the end of the Bodhisattva path, so that I can continually work for the welfare of others without any effort, effortlessly, spontaneously, without the need to think. Then seal that dedication in the emptiness of the three spheres. The merits that we've created in the past and in the present, the merits that will accumulate in the future, appear to our mind in some conceptual form. Those merits do function to bring about something pleasurable within cyclic existence when they ripen upon our continuum, our aggregates. But they themselves are not inherently existent. In the same way that we understand the self is not inherently existent, it still appears and functions. The merits that we're dedicating do not inherently exist. The goals dedicated to do not inherently exist. Continued continuity of practice over many lifetimes, becoming kinder and more beneficial to sentient beings, the achievement of enlightenment. All of these things conventionally exist, do function, but are devoid of the attribute of inherent existence. That little extra poison, so to speak, added to the dish that prevents us from really achieving those states when we grasp at them as being inherently existent. And the process of dedication, joining these merits with those results, the act of dedication, that also is just a name we give to this succession of moments, thinking of the merits, aspiring that they would ripen in these ways. You can't find dedication anywhere on any of those moments, that continuum of thought instances that constitute the act of dedication. The merits being dedicated, the object, the goals dedicated to, and the act of dedication, all are empty of inherent existence. Yet they still function. Thanks for your patience. The squad like at the end, I mentioned the other day at the end of some courses, they might have been, the course might begin with, you know, 70 people or something, and then as the course progresses, less and less. So you're the hardcore. So thank you very much. Hope I'll have a chance to visit again sometime. Maybe in the future, to spend more time on the emptiness part. Right now, we mainly, the part we need now is to put some effort into this experience of recognizing the clear light nature of the mind and using it as an object of concentration. It takes a long time, but don't give up. You need to collect merit, make prostrations, vajrasattva, mandala offerings, practice guru devotion and so forth. And I remember Geshe Rapton, when he was at the monastery, he was Sarajay, when he was studying Majjhimaka, not satisfied with simply studying the Majjhimaka, he did 100,000 prostrations during the curriculum in order to understanding, taking seriously the advice of the gurus. You know, we say, oh yeah, I know we're supposed to do 100,000, but we don't do. He actually did and developed these great realizations. So maybe to encourage you, even if you can't do 100,000, if you do a little retreat, do some portion. You know, if you do a weekend retreat, maybe Friday night do preliminary practices. Then Saturday and Sunday do the, you know, collect some mandalas on Friday and prostrations of vajrasattva, and each morning do a few prostrations and then continue. When you do longer retreats, to do a larger amount of preparation beforehand. There was one Geshe who came to Italy, Geshe Senge, Jampel Senge, I think his name was, and I think I told you about him before. He mentioned when he first came to Italy, he was so impressed with the Italians because they just said what was on their mind. They weren't like so reserved like the Tibetans. But when he was there for some time, a couple of years, he said, his opinion changed. He said, "Ah, the Italians just say whatever's on their mind." Everything comes out. You know? Not necessarily good as he had first thought. You know. So anyway, when he would do with them like a one week retreat together or something, the first couple of days they would collect like 1,000 prostrations, 1,000 mandala offerings and like this. So whatever units, you know, even if it's 10 or 100 or 1,000 as a support for your meditation. And perseverance is the main thing. Have some confidence that these things can be achieved. Leave an imprint in your mind. So thank you very much. Take care.
And now on behalf of all of us here at Kadampa Center, we're going to offer a Thanksgiving mandala to Venerable George. This is a symbolic representation of offering the entire universe, the body, speech, and mind of the Buddhas.
Turkey?
Sorry?
Turkey?
Turkey?
Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving, yes. Oh, yes, a Thanksgiving mandala.
Keto. Keto mandala.
Yeah, a keto mandala. And we can all participate by chanting along, starting on page 100 in the Gold Prayer Book. We will chant the short mandala offering and the request for the Lama to remain long.
The monk.
Saji Puki Jushin Metok Tramri Ravlingji Nide Gyanpa Di Sangye Jindu Mikche Jetsu.
Kuterapten Chi. Come near ya, Tayami.